That came up quicker than I expected. I'm Mary Martha. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is December 10th, 1995. I have a home group, and I have a sponsor. And I'm from, well, right now I'm from Falls Church, Virginia, but I've moved a lot. So you'll hear about that. Anyway, I'm supposed to tell you guys in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'll start at the beginning. I grew up in a really nice family. I grew up in a suburb outside of Chicago, and I had a really nice, normal, whatever that means, family. My parents have been married for 30-some odd years, and I have an older brother, and my parents aren't alcoholics. They are your average, normal people. They, like, I think my mom used to drink pina coladas in the 80s and, like, Bartles and James wine coolers or something. And I tasted them, both of those things, when I was a little kid, but, you know, it never meant anything to me at that time. And my dad, like, used to drink something called a Moscow Mule. I don't even, just because it was served in a copper cup. And that's about his, I mean, like, once or twice, you know, maybe once a year he would have that or something. But, so they're normal people. So I grew up in this little town, and I was thinking about this today, because I feel like from the time I was 7 years old, and I hear this a lot at meetings, so, and this is absolutely my story, from the time I was like 7 or 8 years old, I started to feel like a dis-ease with other people, and I felt like I just didn't fit in, and I knew you guys knew that I didn't fit in, and I remember being in school, and like, I just felt like my clothes looked funny. Like, I was tall for my age, and so my pants were always too short, and I just kind of looked like I felt like I looked like a goon, you know? And it was really just inside that all of that was happening, but I thought everyone could see it, you know? And I just didn't get along with other kids my own age. I really didn't. And I was an average student when I was little, and then I got to be, I don't know, somehow I got to be smarter as I got older or something. But either way, I mean, I was pretty average, but, like, I just didn't think I fit with anybody. And then I started playing the violin, and I felt like a big dork, you know? Everywhere I went, I had this thing with me, and I always loved it, you know? And I liked dorky stuff. But I just didn't want to be a dork. But I mean, that's like the way I came to the world, you know. I brought all that to my first, like, this kind of feeling like I don't really fit in. I brought all that stuff to my first drink. And then when I was 11, we moved from one little suburb to another. And I don't think normal kids would have felt this way, but I was really excited because I'd sort of worn out my welcome in the first place we were living, and I was like, thank God, you know, this comes just in the nick of time, because middle school was about to start, and I was like, this is good, I can start fresh, no one will know me, and I feel like maybe normal 11-year-olds aren't thinking that about, like, moving, you know. I feel like they would be a little sad to miss all their friends or something, but I didn't really have any at that point. And so I moved to this new town, and I thought, I'm going to fit in here. And I used to try to fit in by, like, dressing a certain way. So I thought, like, people would like me if I looked a certain way. And, I mean, I would just do, you know, I was like an alcoholic in training, because I would do stuff that was just stupid. And then wonder why people, like, thought I looked a little funny. Like, I would wear these unbelievable, like, I wore, like, a cowgirl outfit to my first day of, like, middle school. I don't know what I was thinking. Like someone should have told me, don't do that. And then I felt like, oh, I don't really fit in here. Well, no wonder you don't fit in. No one else is dressed up like a cowgirl in the middle of Chicago. But nevertheless, like, just stuff like that that was a little, like, so I brought all this stuff. I'm telling you guys about this because I brought this all in my first drink. But, like, my parents were nice people. They are, you know, do anything for me. They gave me all the lessons and all the tutoring and all the everything that they could possibly provide. And right around when I was like 11 or 12, I realized, I don't know, I kind of like had this intuitive thought, and I'm a snoop by nature, that my brother was probably smoking pot. I just had this, like, intuitive thought, and I snooped around, and sure, you know, I figured it out. But I didn't, excuse me, I didn't do anything with that information. All I did was tell him that it was bad for him, you know, and then that was the end of that. And so for a couple more years, like, I just continued to become more and more, like, self-centered and more and more, like, fearful of the world, pretty much. I mean, without any drink or any drug or anything mood altering, I just got to be really uncomfortable in my own skin. And when I was 13, I attempted to drink and use some drugs. And drugs are part of my story. I'm at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm telling you, you know, about that. But anyway, you don't have to use drugs to be an alcoholic, but you do have to drink. So what happened, I tried to get drunk one time, but nothing really happened. I didn't get that effect produced. And then right around when I was 14, I started smoking cigarettes. And it was just like this funny thing, because on the inside, I was just feeling like I was getting rotted out by, like, self-centeredness. And I didn't even know that that's how it was, but that's how it was, you know? I mean, I just started, I went from being this, like, kind of, like, orchestra geeky person to, like, ditching all those friends, making this whole new pack of friends that the girls called themselves, like, gypsy, you know, gypsy types or whatever, and they were the bad kids, you know. They were definitely the bad girls, and I started being friends with them, because it was like, I just didn't want to feel the way that I felt, and I wanted to, I thought that, like, I was looking to the outside for a solution. So eventually what happened was I took my first drink and I got that effect produced, like the real effect produced. And it was in the summertime and I was with my brother, and the night before we had been out with our cousins who are a little older. My brother's 2 years older than I am, and they offered me some alcohol, and I was, at that time I said, oh, I've done it already, but no, not right now. I'm not going to have any right now. And the very next day I said to my brother, so do you think we could, like, you know, maybe go drink? And he said, sure, you know. So, and I got the effect produced, and I just felt like it was the missing link. Like, it was like, for me, it was love at first sight, you know. This was it. This was exactly what I had been looking for. And in all the, you know, the girls that I was hanging out with, or all these different things that I was trying to do to my outsides to try to fit in, this was what I needed. And I remember thinking that day, like, first of all, I thought he was really holding out on me for not having shared this sooner. And then I thought, I'm never going to be sober again. Like, I just thought, like, I'm never going to not drink, and I did take drugs and stuff too, but I'm never going to be, I don't want to be the way that I felt anymore. And at that time, like, my parents were really hardworking people, and they trusted my brother and I because we had them coming and going. Like, I was wearing these little, like, Laura Ashley dresses and, like, carrying my violin around, you know. They would have never guessed in 1,000 years what we were up to. My brother was, like, captain of the cross-country team. Like, we looked on the outside like the way you're supposed to kind of look. But, you know, behind closed doors, like, we were just, you know, getting drunk all the time. But and so that's what I did. I mean, that's exactly what we did. And from the day that I took my first drink until I got put into rehab, I was drinking, like, almost, not around the clock, but it was like I would wake up in the morning and I would drink, and then I would go to school for a couple hours and then I would drink, you know, and I used drugs, and I just did whatever I could get my hands on. I just wanted the effect produced, and that's what I did. And for a little while there were no consequences because it was the summertime and, like, there was no place to show up. Like, my brother and I both had little jobs at this bank that my dad worked at, and I would show up and, like, I would do embarrassing stuff, like, you know, like, I would laugh so hard about something because I was drunk that I would, like, spit out whatever was in my mouth, like, on a regular basis. You know, just, like, little embarrassing things. But it was not, no, there was no real consequence. Sometimes my brother would get pulled over, but he never got, you know, somehow never got, like, a DUI or anything like that. You know, it was just, so it was like those were the days, you know. And I felt better. And this person that, like, my brother and I had been close, and it was like we reconnected over this because he had kind of gotten distant, or as far as I was concerned, he had. And so this was like we reconnected, and we would lie with each other. So, like, my parents had no idea what was going on. And it, you know, those were the days for a while. What happened was, I remember, like, you know, people talk about, like, stuff that they, you know, different consequences and stuff that happens, like, from drinking. And for me, for a little while there, it felt like everything was going to be okay. forever and ever and ever. And, at that time, it was my dream to, like, maybe become a professional violinist or something like that. And I remember the first time that I showed up drunk to a violin lesson, and it was kind of like, I felt in my gut, like, this is not a good thing. You know, I should not be, shouldn't be doing this right now, but, you know, oh well. I guess, you know, kind of the scheduling is a little off here, so I guess this is just what's going to have to happen. And pretty soon, like, my dreams went from being like, you know, I want to be like this, you know, I want to go to university or conservatory and I'll do all this great stuff, to like, well, I'd really love to die on a cocaine or marijuana plantation in South America, just like blitzed out of my mind by the age of 26. That was like, that's like, you know, the dreams went from being these like pretty little, you know, Hallmark greeting cards to like just kind of not, you know, not really a high aspiration anymore. And I feel like I just lost a train. Oh, yes. And I'll just say I'm 27 today. I got sober when I was 15. So it's kind of funny because I had this, I mean, really for a long time, I was like, Janis Joplin died when she was 26 and that's what I'm going to do, you know? So little things would happen, like little things happen like that, where it was like I was starting to feel a little bit like I couldn't control like when I was doing, you know, it's just like it was more important for me to feel the way that I felt when I drank than it was for me to do the things that I wanted to do. And there's a story in the fourth edition, and I can't remember the name of the story, but this woman talks about how normal people tailor their drinking and partying and all that stuff to their goals, and alcoholics tailor their goals to their drinking. And that's what I was starting. I didn't know that that's what I was starting to do, but that's definitely what I was starting to do, because it was like, well, I'd really like to show up to that class, but like, you know, I'd really rather not show up sober, so let's just go drink anyway. And I remember the first morning of, you know, because I got sober young, my story has always, to me, had a certain, like, namby-pamby, like, kind of silly quality to it, which is just as well for my ego. But I remember the first day of school thinking to myself, and I did one of those big pep talks in the mirror where it's like, today is the first day of school. It was very convincing. Today is the first day of school, Mary Martha. You can't get drunk today. You have to stay sober the whole day because today is a very important day. And, you know, I think, like, I have a friend who got sober young also, and we talk about it, like, that's kind of like the first day of a new job. Like, trying to think of it in a more, when I hear other people's stories, so I can, relate to rather than compare out of. It was a very important day, and I gave myself this big speech, and I walked down the 11 or 13, however many steps it was, down the stairs to the foyer of my parents' house. And I walked out that door, and it mustn't have been 20 steps that I walked, and somehow in between my bedroom and the car, like getting into my brother's car, my mind had changed, and I hadn't really changed it. Like, it was just like, well, you know. And I got in the car, and he pulled out the, you know, everything that we were going to be doing, and I said, and he didn't even have to ask, and it was just like I took it. And I was like, yeah, I'll drink, yeah, I'll do that, yeah. And it wasn't even a question. And I remember that feeling, like just feeling a little bit like this, something's a little wrong here, but I didn't really know what, and it was just kind of like, oh well. And a couple hours later, when I was sitting in Latin class and I dropped my pen about 15 times, I was trying to, like, you know, I was just kind of thinking to myself, and this is why you shouldn't have done this today, you know. But at that, you know, there's some great stuff in the book about this kind of thing, like, where they talk about, like, the fact is the most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of a drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We're unable to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. And at that time, there wasn't, like, a lot of suffering and humiliation, but there were all these little pieces that were starting to come together, like, you know, blatantly ditching friends or family or, you know, things that I cared about just to get drunk and then not remembering what had happened, or, like, I remember, you know, passing out not really kind of falling out of a golf cart at the beach. And actually, I was just remembering this recently because I felt so good. I just didn't care. I just fell right out and I was like, this is great, you know? And I was laying, and like just stupid stuff like that, you know, with people. And my friends were looking at me like, what is your problem? Like, get a hold of yourself, you know? But it didn't matter. And so that happened. And then it just set a precedent like, well, I guess I'm just going to drink it at school now. Because whatever, I already did it once, you know, which is totally my attitude in life in so many different ways. Like, it's like, well, I already did it once, you know, may as well just keep on. and so that happened. And I remember kids that I knew from, like, you know, the couple of years that I've been living in that town that I kind of grew up with, like from middle school, they were saying things to me like, what's wrong with you? You really need to stop hanging out with that guy. And I said, oh, you mean Chris? Not my brother. They said, no, the other guy. And I said, that's my brother. I'm not going to stop hanging out with him. You know, stuff like that. People were saying things like that to me, and I was telling them to F off, you know, and I had a really, my attitude was pretty prickly about things like that. It was like, no, I'll do exactly what I want to do. Thank you very much. And for whatever reason, my parents didn't know what was going on. Well, I know why, because we lied to them repeatedly. They had no idea what was going on, you know, and it's really hard when your only two children are partying together and lying together. So, and so I don't know, that's kind of how it went for a little while. And then fortunately, although I didn't look at it like this at the time, my brother, and I really, man, it's funny. He got in trouble. He got in some trouble with, like, his coach, and the coach said, you have to tell your parents what's going on, otherwise I'm going to. And so he did, and that was sort of like the first stop, you know. We freaked out, and we didn't know what to do, and it was like, oh my God. And he lied to them, of course, and told them, like, oh yeah, I've been, you know, I've gotten drunk a couple times. My parents were like, oh, that's terrible, you know, but nothing was said about what I was up to, and they warned me that if they ever heard of that, they were going to send me to this Catholic all-girls school in our town. And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. And so what happened was we just kept doing what we were doing, you know. It was just like any other time. It was like, now, you know, I remember there was a couple moments of like, oh no, what's going to happen next? And then we went and celebrated, you know, like we called all our friends and it was like, let's go and have a good old time. And stuff would happen. Like, we would go to, at that time raves were kind of big in Chicago. And I mean, I was 15. When I see 15-year-olds now, I think to myself, oh my God, that's terrifying. Like, and I was going to these places that I had no business being in, you know, and just like, the places that the checkpoints alone to go to those kind of parties were not nice places. And I thought I was the coolest thing. Like, I thought, this is it, you know, this is what I want to do. And I don't know. So what happened was my parents, like, we eventually got caught. And my brother was kind of a big part of my story because we ended up getting sober together. So we got caught. And they eventually sent us to rehab. And this is kind of a funny little thing too, because the day that we got caught, my mom held a gun up to my brother and was like, with like a bullet in and everything. It was very, very interesting turn of events. she was like holding it. She was like wielding a gun. This whole big, like, kind of crazy scene took place, and she was like, you know, she still didn't know that I was drinking or using drugs or anything like that. And she told him, you know, if you ever do anything like this, she was threatening to kill him pretty much. And now it's kind of, now we don't even talk about it anymore, but it's kind of funny to me now, except that I, like, thought to myself, yeah, he really does need to straighten up, you know. And there I was in, like, lockstep with him doing what I was doing, you know, doing what we were doing. And I just thought, like, he really needs to straighten up. And my reaction was, yeah, he really has a problem, and I'm worried about him too. And I really hid behind that for a while, for a long while. And I definitely was like, yeah, what a bottom he hit. You know, why can't he just, he should really wake up to this. And it's like, I missed the point that I was there too, and that I had been doing the exact same thing, and that had my mother known that, she would have been pointing the gun in my direction too, you know. But we ended up getting sent to this, like, rehab, and I just didn't think I belonged there. It was like, I'm going to keep track of time here. Okay. So I didn't think I belonged there. I thought, like, I definitely knew my brother belonged there. and I thought, you know, I really had the attitude that, like, most people that I know anyway talk about, like, well, if you had my parents, if you had my, you know, if you were as dorky as I was, you would want to be drunk too. And I didn't stay sober at that during that time. I just kept right on doing whatever I felt like doing. And I kind of tried to hide it a little bit more. And I had a plan. I always like to have a plan. My plan was that I was going to try to clean up for 90 days. Because I kept hearing people talk about 90 days. And I figured, well, that's as good a time as any. So I'm going to try to, like, get my parents to think that I'm okay for 90 days. And then after that, then I can do whatever I want. And then I also had an alternate plan, which was if my mom ever pulls any funny business again, I'm leaving. And so I kept it backpacked, actually, for my whole first year of sobriety, thinking, like, any moment now, you know, I'm going to bust out of here. And it didn't really have anything to do with my mom. You know, like, now that I think about it, it had nothing to do with her or her behavior. It had everything to do with, like, you know, this, like, I just didn't really, I wasn't really committed to the idea of changing my life in any way. The only change I really wanted was to, like, leave, you know. I figured, like, a geographic would suit me just fine. So I don't know. So I didn't get sober then, but they had us go to these AA meetings. And I went to AA meetings in this town, like, a town north of Chicago, like, about an hour north. And everybody in the room was like, I mean, it seemed to me, this wasn't the case, but it seemed to me that everybody in the room was like 75 and male, you know? And I was 15 and female, and I was like, what am I doing here? And then everybody in the rehab, I actually was the only girl in the treatment at that time. And so I just thought, like, I can't be an alcoholic. I just can't. I mean, first of all, I'm a girl, and you guys are all men. And second of all, I'm really young, and you're all a little older, you know? And whether that was the other guys in rehab or the people in meetings. And, you know, it took for me, like, coming to meetings and going to that rehab and looking around the circle and doing, I remember this, like, really clearly. I had this, like, sort of moment of clarity, sort of, where I went around the room and I was mentally pointing my finger at everybody, and then I got back to myself. And I had sort of identified, like, why they were all there. Well, that guy, you know, he did this, and then he, you know, got into a car crash. And I went through the whole everybody, and I just couldn't figure out what I was doing there. And it was like, well, if 15 people in the room belong here, and I'm number 16, the hell am I doing here, you know? And it kind of got to be like that in AA, too. Like, it's like, well, people would tell me things like, normal 15-year-olds don't just happen to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, they aren't just like, oh, well, then I went to the, you know, I went to the pep rally, and then I just went to an AA meeting, and then I, you know, I went over to the you know, student government meeting, and, you know, it's like not in the normal course of business. So, and that didn't help me at the time. I was kind of like, well, this must be an accident. Look at my brother. He's such a, you know, wacko. But I don't know. I said a prayer. I really believe, like, people, I've heard a lot of stories, and I've heard a lot of people talk about it, like, their moment where I said this prayer, and I didn't think anybody was listening, and apparently God was listening, because I said one of those prayers, and it kind of chokes me up, because I said, God, I just don't know what to do. And I remember I was like, I was not staying sober. I was in this stupid rehab that I hated. I was, like, living in my parents' house. And I hated living there, even though they had never done anything wrong to me, you know? And I just felt like nothing's, like, I was terrified because, you know, something that really hit me in AA was, like, I heard these people tell stories about, like, drinking and drinking for years on end and nothing ever changing. And all I ever wanted was to, like, not feel the way that I felt, you know? I just really wanted to change. And I didn't know how to do that. And I thought, like, you know, my dream was to die young, but I was like, what if I don't die? Like, I was really afraid. I was 15, and I'm like, man, with my record, I'm going to keep waking up for a long time, you know? Because I just kept waking up, and I was like, this is unbearable. Because every morning, I was like, I was really like, and I didn't mention this, but I remember feeling like that the first, I had a couple experiences where, like, alcohol had stopped working. Too, before that, like, before I said that prayer, and I think that night was one of those times where it really didn't work, where it was, like, I was somewhat inebriated, but I was totally, my brain was, like, you know, just making all this noise the way it used to, And I just thought, like, what if I don't die in the next year and it just stays like this for, like, 20 more years? What then? I'm going to go crazy, you know? And I said that prayer, and I didn't think anything happened. And then, like, a couple days later, you know, like, my brother offered for me to go drink with him. And for some reason, I said, I'll be there in 5 minutes. Which I never said in my life. You know, I never had pause. I always said yes. And then I didn't drink that day. And I haven't had a drink since, you know, December 9th, 1995. And I don't really know why. Like, I think it's that's why. But, you know, I mean, I didn't plan it that way. I got sober. I eventually got this lady to sponsor me. And this lady, Nancy Higgins, she's passed away. And she was I don't know how old she was. I think 65. I just kind of picked a number. But she was the most lovely lady. She had like 25 years sober. And she brought me to her house. And I got sober in a tiny town where there was like, you know, like I said, a lot of, like, mostly like older people. And the meetings were really tiny. And everybody knew everybody else. And she, there were like a couple young people, but they kind of, I was a little too young for them to even hang out with. And she took me to her house and made me hot cocoa in her microwave. I remember that like really clearly because it was like I hadn't been invited to place like something like that like in a long time because all the girls that I had been friends with were just like, you're too much, you know, like they didn't want to get in trouble, you know, and I was really mean to people. And so I got sober, and, you know, I didn't really mean to, and she got me a sponsor that really worked the steps with me, because she was like, I don't think I can really help you, but there's this woman, Anne, who likes to work with younger women, and I started working the steps with this woman, and she was, I mean, the woman was pretty nutty, but she was awesome. Like, she worked steps with me, like, showed, you know, just kind of, like, guided me through the program, like, one step at a time, and she would do, I mean, she did, like, wacky stuff that appealed to my wacky sensibility, like during my fourth step. I read my fourth step to her, and she took out a smudge stick, which I don't know if anybody knows, like the Native American tradition of smudging, where you got like bound dried sage and you like burn it, and it's supposed to clear, like purify the air and the spirits. Yeah, she did stuff like that, you know, which was awesome for me because I was like new and I was young, and I just felt like. And she was a really eccentric lady, and we would go downtown to Chicago, because I had these, like, big dreams. I always wanted to run away. I'd be like, Anne, I think I got to run away. I'm going to run away to Chicago, you know? And she'd be like, no, stay there. But then she would take me on these, like, little outings, and we worked steps, you know? Like, I did the fifth step with her, you know, we did six and seven. I got really caught in seven. It was like, what am I doing? How am I going to remove these things? Then it was like, no, God is going to do this for me. And I started, you know, working on amends. And then, you know, I mean, all this, like, amazing stuff happened. And I'm going to talk a lot about my experience in recovery, because a lot of amazing stuff has happened since I got sober. You know, I mean, I wanted to go to college, like, once I got sober and started to, like, the fog cleared a little bit, I started to have, you know, some dreams again, and I got to go to the school that I wanted to go to, and you know, it was people in AA just being really supportive, like, just telling me, like, okay, you know, keep showing up, you gotta keep, and I mean, I did stupid stuff, too. You know, in sobriety, like, not showing up to class for, like, months on end and then, like, getting D's and stuff, like, was not that stupid, you know? And people would, you know, and it just, like, I didn't know how to live, you know? And they say, like, alcoholics drank for the effects produced, and I also drank because the way that I was living was totally wrong, you know? It was just, like, unbearable to be sober and live like such a jerk. And you know, I remember being a year sober and really wanting to drink again. And the real problem was that I was totally lying to, like, all these other, you know, I started up all the lies again, you know, I just started, like, not telling anybody that I was ditching classes and not telling, you know, people what was really going on with me. And so, no kidding, I wanted a drink. And so, you know, but people in AA really, like, stuck by me and they're like, you know, and helped me, you know, like she walked, like Anne walked me through that too, and then I went off to college in New York, and I got to, you know, do that for, and that was like, and this is actually a funny part of the story is like, what happened was I got all these amazing gifts. And as you often hear in AA, like, I got all these gifts, and then I started to just kind of take it all for granted. Unfortunately, I didn't have to get drunk again, but I went on, like, what I think is, like, the self-will hiatus, where I had sponsors in name only. And I went to a fair amount of AA meetings, though. I mean, I was always active in that sense. Like, I would show up physically at an AA meeting, usually on time, and I would, like, call the sponsor a couple times a week and kind of give her after-action reports. Like, well, today, this really messed up thing happened, you know? I don't know. And then, what can a sponsor do with that? Not much, because it's like, well, this is what I did. And it's like, okay, well, call me before you do that next time, maybe. But, you know, I was in college, and I just kind of, I just grew distant from having real sponsorship and working the steps, and I would have like a little service commitment. But it was always like, you know, just something that I did. It was kind of like, it wasn't really as integrated a part of my life as it had been. It was kind of like I took, you know, I had like anthropology, and then I went to AA, and then I had my coffee making, and then I would go to like fiction writing, or, you know, like I had, or math or whatever. Like, it's just another part of the schedule, but it wasn't really like a way of life for me. And you know, I kept praying though, and I tried to like keep an inventory, and I have a lot of years of really weird inventory of like, you know, mental meanderings. So I stayed, you know, I went to college and then I went to grad school, and like all these great things were happening on the outside, and I feel like my outsides actually kind of grew apart from what my insides were in a lot of ways. Like, because I don't know, for me, like, I'm, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I need like everything that AA has to offer, you know, and I was really taking it piecemeal for a while there, like a long, long, dangerous while. And for like 8 years, I just kind of, wasn't quite 8 years, but more or less, like I would have a sponsor wherever I moved. And I lived in, I'll tell you right now really quickly, I lived in, first I was in New York, then I was in Paris, then I went back to New York, then I was in Vermont, then I was in Northern Virginia, then Maryland, then Switzerland, then Maryland, then Chicago, then Northern Virginia. And I always had sponsors, so that way if somebody would say, do you have a sponsor, I could be like, her, you know, and I always came to meetings, like 4 or 5 meetings a week, and I had like usually one commitment. I maybe have one service commitment, maybe not, because I was really busy for a long time there. I was very busy building an empire, and and, you know, the sad thing is, like, I pretty much like got myself into a profession that I have no interest in being in because I thought it looked good, you know. But that's, which is fine. it's just a funny thing, like, you know, because I can be sober and totally self-willed and sober and create wreckage, and I created a lot of wreckage with like my family, sober. I mean, like stuff that had healed from working the steps the first time with a sponsor was like reopened and just worse. You know, calling my mom and complaining about my life, telling my dad, you know, just like swearing at my father, like doing all this stuff sober, but crazy. You know, really dry, I think, is a better way of putting it, because it's not sober as we define it in AA. And as like a side note, my brother and I did get sober together, and his sobriety date was December 15th of 1995. And for 7.5 years, he stayed sober, and then he went back out, and he's been back out since. And what happened in those years when I was like just dry was I created a lot of wreckage with him too, because it was like I was no example of AA, you know. Like when he was drinking again, I was an utter crazy, you know what, and just like kind of living like a dry drunk, really. Those are scary times, because it got like worse and worse. I mean, just like treating people in an appalling fashion, lying again, you know, just doing stuff to like just being, like, not taking anybody's suggestions, calling people and, like, using them, like, a whipping post for my, like, you know, alcoholic emotions. And I want to read a little thing out of We Agnostics, because I really, like, this is the way that I felt for, like, a lot of years. Like, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we could see newsreels of lunar flight? And what happened during that period of time was, like, I just had, like, no, I mean, I think I had the first step, but just barely, and I had nothing else in my life. It was just, like, and I was coming to meetings and, you know, shaking hands and trying to be of service, but scary times. And eventually what happened was I landed in Washington, D.C. for, because my grand plan had finally worked out, you know, and I didn't even, I was miserable. And I finally got this job that I thought I wanted, and it was like just, I mean, man, living dry is just so not fun. And I was like seconds, and like Sharon talks about seconds and inches from taking that next drink, you know, because it was like, this is not working. I was worse. I treated my parents worse than my brother did, who was drinking. I treated people in my life pretty poorly because I was just like a self-centered alcoholic, and the only thing missing really was the drink. So I landed in D.C. and I knew about this group from a friend of mine. And the only, I had been to some meetings before that some of these people went to, and I really liked the meetings. And a couple funny little weird things happened. Like, I had been to the meetings before, and the only reason I went in the first place was because this girl had made an amend to me. And I could see that she had really, like, of course, I owed her one, too, but at the time, I was like, oh, thank you, you know, I was so pompous, but I could see that she had really changed, like, she seemed much better, and she was going to these meetings, and then, and I'd known these girls, so I met some people there, and then, like, 4 years had passed, and I moved back to the same Northern Virginia area, and oddly, before I moved there, in a random little, I was living in Easton, Maryland, which is like a tiny town on the Eastern Shore. This girl shows up at a meeting and raised her hand when we said, are there any visitors? And she's like, I'm visiting from Washington, D.C. And I was like, that girl's got to be from that group, because she had so much like crazy energy flying out of her, and she was so like just assertive. And I thought like, and afterwards I went up to her and I asked her, and sure enough she was. And I got her phone number. And then a couple months later, I found out I was moving to D.C., and I had her phone number in, like, a wadded little thing in my car, like, in one of the cup holders, on, like, a receipt from a restaurant that we had eaten at. And it was, just because I'm unmanageable enough to have a dirty car like that, her phone number was still there. And I was driving into Washington, D.C., and I was like, well, maybe I'll give this girl a call. Because I normally, when I would move, I would always do the big AA thing and say, well, call Central Group, you know, find out where the meetings are. But this particular time, I was just kind of like, there's nothing in AA for me. Like, I really felt like there's nothing in, I don't think there's anything in AA for me. I think maybe I need to get a therapist and, like, get on meds or something. You know, I don't know what I thought. I was just, like, done. And, but I called this girl. And she, of course, because she's, like, little Miss AA, calls me right back and told me where the meeting was and sent me, and then gave me, like, five other people's phone numbers. And then people started calling me and I did not want to be there. I was just like, these people are a little too much for me. You know, and I was so jaded. Like, this was like a year and a half. This was July of 06. I was so jaded. I was like, there's just no way. I had had, like, a previous sponsor had told me she thought I just needed to, like, get some, like, psychiatric help. Because I was so, I mean, and this is the way I treat, this is like, you know, dry, drunk, running my life, you know, not taking any direction, not doing anything that we're supposed to do. None of this was in my life. And, but I could cite it, you know. I could tell you what page that was on. I could tell you all about the acceptance thing. And if somebody else was having a problem, I could tell you where to look for a solution. But I was starving, you know. So anyway, so I went to this meeting, and I don't know. Like, it's just, to me, this is like the real miracle of AA kind of happened for me in the last, like, year and a half. Like, I mean, it happened, you know, 12 years ago, but the real miracle is, like, in the last year and a half, like, I started going to these meetings. I don't know how my sponsor put up with me, because I was unbearable. Like, I was dry, but I thought I knew everything, and I didn't know why people didn't want me to speak at their meetings, like, but I was really unbearable, and I didn't know that, like, having, you know, everywhere I had been before this, having some time and being young, I was treated like, I like to use this expression, like a unicorn, because people would come up and be like, oh my God, you're young and you're sober more than 5 years, oh my God, you know, or whatever it was at the time, you know, they would just, and I felt like, yes, I am, I'm very rare, it's very interesting to be me, you know, and like, even though I was totally dying from alcoholism, dry, I thought, like, I'm so special, because I stayed sober, And when I went to these meetings, it was like, dime a dozen, baby, take a seat, you know. Because there were a ton of people that were young and sober for a long period of time, and they just didn't even care. They were like, shut up, you know. Why are you spreading that disease on everybody? Like, and I got this sponsor who, like, and something cool happened when I got there. Like, these girls that I had seen four years ago, I lived in the area for a couple months doing an internship. And also a big part of my plan, and I felt very important. but these girls that had been new, they were newcomers when I had been there 4 years ago, now had 4 years of sobriety, and it was like Lindsay was engaged. Like Lindsay was, when I met her, 90 days sober and thinking about going back to school. But like totally crazy and all over the place. And 4 years later, she was engaged to be married, about to graduate college, and like had been, you know, working the same job for a couple of years. And then like this girl, Sophie, was, you know, again, like dropped out of school. You know, you couldn't have a conversation with her that lasted more than 30 seconds without her like just kind of combusting and like, and now she was like 4 years sober, you know, in school, had her life together, sponsoring people, helping people. And I was like, this is it was like real proof to me that something was working, and it gave me a lot of hope, because I felt like AA doesn't work, you know. I really thought, like, I've tried AA and it just doesn't work, and I'm going to need to do something else now, and so I got this sponsor who kicked my butt, and just like asked me to do stuff that I thought was not necessary anymore, given all of my sobriety, and I my attitude was awful, but. She somehow got me to start coming to meetings again and, like, you know, acting like a member of AA. Like, helping, like, clean up, put the chairs up, you know, just doing the basic stuff. Doing an inventory every night. And I used to call her with all this weird stuff, like, you know, I just call her with after-action reports because that's what I was used to doing. And she wouldn't listen. And I would call her with, like, emotional tirades. Like, I would call her just weeping and screaming on the phone. And she would be like, I'm not going to listen to this. You're going to have to call someone else and end the conversation. And then I would call her and tell her that I had done something like that with my mother. And she would be like, that is unacceptable behavior. And the cool thing that has happened in the last year and a half since I've had real sponsorship and stuff is... It's like some of the stuff that's happened with my family and like and trying to really live AA. I don't know, like my parents came out to visit last year and like they visited and stayed in my apartment and like slept on my bed and I slept on the air mattress. Where, I mean, I would never do stuff like that before. I was like, you know, there's an expression like F you got mine, you know, kind of like screw you, I've got mine. I don't, you know. And I used to be, like, in sobriety, I was such a taker with my parents. I would let them buy me expensive presents all the time. And I would kind of, not even let them is a really generous way to put it. No, I would demand all this stuff. Like, it was like, well, of course you're going to give this to me. And, you know, it's just not the case anymore. And my brother, who's been in and out of AA for the last 5 years, he, like, kind of cool. Like, he called me on my anniversary. And, there was a time when, like, he didn't really want to talk to me because it was like, I was just such a jerk. Like, I was dry, and I was such a jerk. And I remember him saying, like, if this is sobriety, I don't want it, you know? And I felt like, yeah, me neither. You know? I'm sorry, I'm weeping a lot here. But it's really cool. Like, this last summer, he came out and visited, and came to my home group and spent a weekend with me in Ocean City. And he said, you know, I really think I could stay sober if I lived out here. And, you know, of course, like, whatever. But it just, it was, like, pretty amazing because this was somebody who had told me, like, you know, you're such a jerk. Like, I don't want to be sober. I don't even want to. He had told me, like, he didn't want to be around me because when I, because dry, without a program in my life, I act like a big jerk to people, and I trample on them, and I just, you know, and I used to, like, give him lectures about how he needed to get sober. I mean, just terrible stuff that I did dry because I had no program, and then he came out and visited me, and the only reason he was willing to come out was because I started to shut my big mouth when I talked to him and just listened to what he had to say, you know, and I started to do what people do in AA, like, and it's just pretty incredible because, you know, that relationship is, like, getting better and better now, like, and he called me on my anniversary to wish me a happy anniversary, and, you know, he's not around my parents very much because they don't want to see him when he's not sober, but for Thanksgiving, he, was dry for all that time and just to be with me. And he's doing this again on Christmas. And, he's really hard to bear because he's, really dry and, crazy, but it's pretty awesome because it's like, he didn't want to be around me before, you know? And, because of AA, like, we have a relationship and, there's, like, a lot of other cool stuff that's happened in the last year and a half that I've been, like, actually working in this program and finally sponsoring somebody after, like, a long time of my sponsor telling me, like, you need to be helping people. Thank you, Anna. and it's just really cool because it's, like, I came to AA, like, you know, a couple of years ago, I feel like I'm in, like, a new sobriety. Fortunately, I didn't have to drink to get it, you know, but like, I really feel like I came here with, like, just thinking this is not going to work, and it's really been a lot of work, and I've gotten a lot less sleep in the last year and a half than I'd gotten in a long time, but I've also had so much more joy in my life, like, you know, I just have so many people that I really love and care about now, and, you know, for me, like, my alcoholism wants me alone so it can get me to drink and it will kill me. And I really believe that. And I believe that, like, when I'm not drinking, I'm in an unnatural state for an alcoholic. And the only way that I can bear it is to get like a changed, is to have like this spiritual awakening, you know, or some kind of like change. And, you know, and for me, it's really, like, through people and through working, like, the steps and really working this thing and, like, getting involved in service and having, you know, and, man, there are so many times that, like, in the last year and a half where I was like, this has got to be the last straw, you know, because my time was so valuable to me that I was almost right. I wouldn't have given up my time even if it meant it would have kept me sober or happier, you know. I mean, I just wasn't giving up my time. And I was like, I'm too important now, you know, the career that I don't want, I'm an attorney by training, and I don't, what's that all about? But you know, I just had all this, like, self-importance built up over years of not really being useful here, and my sponsor just could really give a crap about it, you know. I would tell her, like, well, I have to work in the morning. She's like, well, what do you think we do in the morning, you know? And it's really funny because it's like I came to DC for this job because I thought this was going to fix me. And by the grace of God, I got this like a new sobriety without having to, you know, just like a total new, like really a new lease on life. And really what this book talks about, like I feel like a lot of the stuff I'm feeling for the first time. And so that's good news because if you're new, you too can feel this for the first time, and it really works. Like this program really works, and it's only like all I have to do is pick up this like simple set of tools. Like they're really laid at my feet here in AA, and I don't know. And the other thing is, if you've been around for a while and you don't feel that like warm, like, my heart froze up, you know, my heart freezes up without contact with other people and without a lot of interaction, and so if you've been around for a while and your heart's frozen again, you know, thaw it out. Like, you can thaw it out with this book and a lot of work. But it's so worth it, you know. Like, people came over to my house Thursday night to decorate my little Christmas tree. And it was like such a joy. And yeah, I was up till 12:30 and had to get up for 6 for work the next morning. But you know, I, just people like me die alone, you know. And anyway, so I'm going to read this. I really got choked up talking to you all. But anyway, our book is meant to be, this is from the big book. And if you're new, this is on page 164. It's at the very end of the meat and potatoes of AA. So it says, our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for a man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Okay. Now that I've snotted up the podium. I think that's about all I have to share. If I share any more. But thanks for letting me be here tonight, Billy, and thanks for having such a nice welcoming group here. And I don't know. So if you're new and you didn't hear, and all the what I just said was wah 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 wah, keep coming back and get a sponsor. Thanks.